Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Bernice Barry was recently interviewed by William Yeoman at the City of Perth Library about her new novel, The Names of a Hare.
Well, I'm really fascinated to know about and we can go right back to something like Virgil's The Aeneid with Aeneas, who was a minor character in Homer's The Iliad, but becomes like this huge figure. And right through, we're talking about the wide psychosocy, Jean Rhys's book, and we're thinking about the first Mrs. Rochester, not a minor figure, but still in the background. Is there essentially a difference between giving someone a life if they're historical figures versus fictional figures? For example, could you see yourself doing this, like taking a figure from a book? I mean, I guess this is an example, but it was based on a real woman. But taking them from a book, a minor character, giving them, fleshing out this entire life and giving it to them. Is there a difference between that as a fictional character and, or is it more important to you that it has to be someone who existed?
I think the important thing for me is just, in fact, the perfect situation for me is that I know that person was real, and it needs to be a woman. Well, so far, it needs to be a woman, and it needs to just be someone that I know. There was a woman who lived, and she had a life. The fact that I can make the life up, because almost nothing is known about that person, is just a delight. It's like, I suppose it must be the way other writers of fiction feel when they just write fiction. They just enjoy writing fiction. All I need is for it to be a real woman. The situation where quite a lot would be known about that person historically, so there'd be some sort of connected points of events through their life, that would be a lot less attractive to me. I would rather write that as historical non-fiction, narrative non-fiction, and stick to those facts. I found it very difficult when I was writing narrative non-fiction to tear myself away in the tiniest way from what I knew to be the truth. I know a lot of writers who write historical fiction mess around with the dates, or they move people around, or they change names, they add new characters who didn't exist, they add a love story that wasn't there. I couldn't bear to do that, because I suppose that's the historian in me, and the obsessive in me. If I know that's what happened, that's what has to happen, and that's restrictive to me. So I'd much rather do that as a biography and do it really well and try and do it in a storytelling kind of way. But no, the perfect situation is there was a woman. We know almost nothing about her. Yes. let me write her story.
And I guess that's where the sense of mystery comes from as well. No, we don't know this person. about to find out.
Let me tell you.
Yeah, it's beautiful. just going back to the book itself, we're thinking about how much you seem to be in love with language itself, not just the people who utter these words, but you toy around with so many different words, not to mention the various names for the hair, for example. Where did that whole story come from?
The hair? Mm. The names of hair? Oh, it's a long answer, I'm afraid. Well, it's to begin with, the connection between the character and the hair. The character in the book is told never, when she has to flee from her home because she's accused of murder by witchcraft when she's still a young girl. And she's warned never to come home and never to reveal her name. So she goes through the book using different names and different aliases. And the connection with the hare is that in mythology and folklore, the hare has magical powers and strong associations with witches and witchcraft. And so there are many, many stories in a lot of different cultures that you must be very careful with hares because the hare might be a witch, and you should never use the name of the hare. You should always call it by its alias. And there are many different folk aliases for hares, depending on which part of the UK is what I know about, but whichever part you go to. There was a 13th century poem written. It's in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. It's written in Anglo-Norman, so kind of half English, half French. Very strange writing, difficult to decipher. And it's a poem which lists, I think, about 65 different names used for the hare. And the mythology, the stories say that if a hare crosses your path, you should honour the hare by taking something from your clothing or something you're carrying and lay it down, and then you should honour the hare. So I decided that that would be the connection in the story, the girl who is never named and the hare who is never named. And I used that that poem, I transcribed it and used it to sort of concoct an incantation which the woman in the story uses each time she sees the hare, because the hare recurs in her story, in her life, in quite significant ways.
Indeed. Just saying on language for a moment, I'm really interested to know your thoughts around words, because sometimes I feel you words seem sacred, and it seems like some of these words are almost objects in themselves. But as most of us know, I think meanings are not fixed, they're fluid, and so much meaning comes from context. And I'm wondering, does that ever bother you, that you can't pin down a word to that, this is the essential nature of the word, like this is a rock?
Yeah.
But it's changing all the time.
That's such a great question. I like that you said words are sacred, because I've never thought of it in that specific way, but I think that's what it is for me. And funnily enough, there is a little passage in the book. I read it at an event last night, actually, where the main character is talking about that magic that happens where you feel something or you see something and you want to keep it. So you find words for it, you write it. And she describes how you think and think and think, but because there are so many words to choose from, but eventually you will find the one word that gets it, that says what you felt or what you saw, and you write it. And then long after you've gone from the living memory of any other human being, one day a reader will find that word and they will feel what you felt and know what you were, what you saw, what you felt. And that really is one of the main themes that underlies the book. It's the main reason, really, that I wanted to write this particular book. It's the power of words. Words are the most potent thing that we have. And the idea that the sharing of a story is a magical thing. I do think it's magic. You know, I sit south of Margaret River in my study and I write something. And a year later, a person that I will never meet, that I don't know, who lives in the United States, sends me an email and says, "You made me cry." That's magic. And it's the words that are doing it. It's nothing else. And it's but it's not really the words, it's the human connection between the writer and the reader. And I'm back to what I said before. That's why I spend so many hours doing it. that connection, that magic connection.
Actually, that's a lovely idea, that connection, because that means you can be assured of some kind of relationship between the reader, even though you're actually casting a different spell every time you encounter a different reader, because they're bringing their own experience, their own such and such to the experience.
It's something else that I've realised quite recently, actually, since I wrote the book, but since I've been talking about the book a little bit more over the last few weeks, why it is that relationship is important to me. And I think now that, writing is a very solitary experience, and I'm quite a solitary person. I know today I'm a person who describes themselves as neurodiverse. I didn't know that 10 years ago. And so I've always found it quite difficult to have connections with people. You know, I don't have a lot of friends. Mm. I like people. Mm. I have friends. But not a lot of really close friends. And when I was a child, I always felt a bit different, a bit sort of excluded, and I always wanted to be included. And I do wonder whether the reason I feel this way about the connection through writing is because what's happening with the books, particularly this book, for some reason more than the others, I have people telling me that they've connected with me, that they feel some kind of closeness with the ideas that I'm talking about. So for the first time in my life, I'm actually experiencing this human close connection that I haven't felt in that way before. Mm. And I just wonder if that's what's really going on.
Yeah, it's like another form of
magic,
isn't it?
Sharing yesterday.
do you therefore, I mean, I'm glad you brought up neurodivergence and so forth, because I'm wondering if you think, do you feel bereft? Do you feel we've lost something through the way we talk about difference today versus the way difference might have been framed in past times, for all the ugliness but also all the beauty of those characterizations?
I don't think that we've lost something. I think it's been an opening for me to realize that, I mean, you know, when I was a child and a young woman, I thought it was me, and there was something wrong. There was something weird. I was an alien. And it wasn't really until I was probably about 60 that I realized what was going on, and it wasn't my fault. I was just different, and there were others like me. Mm. So I think that's been incredibly helpful. It's one of the reasons why I decided, soon after I started writing the book, I realized that this character had, I was writing her with a sort of obsessive personality, particularly in the precision with the making of the medical remedies. And I realized that probably I was putting myself into that. And that was when I realized that there were probably people like me in the 17th century. Mm. And I thought it would be good maybe to be useful and helpful to other people to read about someone like them. So I don't think we've lost anything. I think it's been a wonderful opening up.
Yeah, I guess I was talking more, not so much about that process, which you're right, you haven't lost anything. In fact, we've gained, but more in a sense of the kinds of language, the kind of words we use, which seem to me to be sometimes excessively as though we're medicalizing a certain condition, which is not necessarily like that. It's not mechanistic like that. It's not dehumanizing like that. So I guess that's what I was trying to point out. Whereas in the past, we've had much more poetic, more beautiful language to describe the same conditions.
Yes. Yeah, I think using words like neurodiverse or autism or any of the other phrases that I use, is that in a sense is quite limiting. It's almost like this is what you are, when actually what I've come to understand, as she says in the book, we're all unique and wonderful, and we're all different, and it's just that I'm there, and it just happens that many of the other people I know are there. It's a little bit limiting, and as you say, a bit scientific, but I think still helpful.
I mean, that's fair enough, of course. Well, we'd love to hear from you soon, read something from the book. But before we do that, just one last question from me, which was a little bit more about your writing process and how that might have changed over the course of writing these books.
It hasn't really changed. I love the research so much. I think I wouldn't want to write a book unless it required me to do a lot of research, because that's very much part of it. And I still write very slowly because I do the research as I'm writing. So I'm editing all the time. It is a very slow process. I can veer off for 3 weeks doing research, going down the rabbit holes. And I always say, you know, people say, don't go down the rabbit holes. You will disappear for weeks and you'll waste time. I've actually found some of my really best material down those rabbit holes and changed what I've been writing because of what I've... But that is a luxury because I have time, you know, because of my age and my time in life. My time is my own for writing most of the time. So the process hasn't changed. That my the way that I store my research is still completely haphazard. I drive my husband mad, asking him to find files for me that I have no idea where I filed it or what it was filed under. So yeah, the process is still the same, very slow. But it does mean that when I finished and the manuscript goes to my agent and then she submits it, I don't undergo a lot of heavy editing afterwards because the editing has already been done. Mm. I'm writing during the day, and then at the end of the afternoon, I email myself the latest version of the manuscript, and then in bed in the evening, I read the bit that I've written on my iPad, because when you look at something in a different format, you see things. And I often read it aloud because you hear repetition and near repetition that you don't spot when you're just reading on screen. And you also hear the rhythm of the language and how it's sort of pacing. And then I just send myself emails. I spot things I want to change or words I want to alter, or, you know, this bit doesn't make sense, or send myself a row of emails. And then first thing in the morning when I get back to my desk, the first thing I do is act on all those emails. And I think of that as kind of limbering up, you know, that's the warm up. That's the 10 minutes on the treadmill. And it gets my head back into the writing. And then is the really good bit, which is the next new bit of writing. Mm. So that's fiction, nonfiction. I still do that in the same way.
Sounds like you've conquered the blank page to some extent by the, you know, the kinds of strategies you've come up with. So speaking of the sound, rhythm and so forth of the language, would you like to read us something?
I'd love to. I'll just have a sip of water first.
Of course.
Getting a bit croaky. So you just need to know for this bit, this is towards the end of the main character's life, and she's a healer, she's a herbalist, and she's just been helping someone with a remedy, and on the way home she's been accosted by a group of men who are accusing her of witchcraft. And she's living with a man called Amos. She's probably in her 60s at this point. It's always very difficult to choose.
Just hold that for you. You can read.
No, I'm all right.
You're okay.
I'll be fine,
you're
yeah, okay. Once I get going. It's always difficult to choose a bit to read. You know, I'd like to read you a description of one of the places I really love, or I'd like to read you a bit about magic or a bit about love, but I chose this bit because it's a bit about love and it's also a bit about magic. When I got home, Amos was seated at the table, staring at his hands. I'd never seen him so still. I guessed he had already heard about the fuss at Martineau. This work you do, it's kindness to your fellow beings, I know, but please be careful. He made me sit and rest, stoked the fire to bigger flames, and I watched him while he scaled and gutted 8 herrings, poured vinegar over them and salted them, rubbing their silver skins with the palms of his hands. When he skewered them with their own tails in their mouths and dropped them into the pot to boil, the way he'd seen me do it so often. I recognized something for the first time in every small piece of me. What I felt for that man was love. He played the good wife that night, put my plate in front of me with a smile and a sauce of horseradish, chervil and butter, and he poured my ale. We ate quickly, spoke not a word, and he was gone long before dawn to catch the tide for more herring. That silent meal in a small stone-built house with a man who never knew my real name, the simple salty feast we shared that came from his own fishing nets, that is what I would choose to keep by me if the end of life is reduced to one single memory. After that, we carried on as we always had, but we both knew a flame had been lit and it would not burn out quickly. Weeks passed, but there was something musty in the air, and it followed me everywhere, in the house, on the street, like the shadow of someone arriving before its owner appears. I walked the coast path alone at dawn and sunset to look for warnings, and they were always there. The trees never let me down. A white owl flew out from the rowan by the crag every morning and glided long and low ahead of me, a message from the living. Each evening, a blackbird offered his last song, pure and piercing, from the hawthorn tree, a message from the dead. When I knew for sure, I kept it to myself. Matthew Hopkins was coming. He was coming for me.
That was beautiful. So, tell us more about, in complete contrast to that, Matthew Hopkins.
Yeah, I realised as I said that, that we hadn't actually mentioned
him
yet. So Matthew, Matthew Hopkins is coming. So Matthew Hopkins is one of the characters who really did exist. And you may have heard of him if you know that he was also known as the Witchfinder General. I was quite interested to discover when I was doing the research that that wasn't an official title. He called himself the Witchfinder General, which led me to create a character that was particularly egotistical. I decided that he would also probably be someone who was very good looking and very confident because he conned so many people for several years. He was really responsible for the execution of hundreds of innocent women for witchcraft, for murder by sorcery. And he was doing that for about 3 years altogether, so not very long. And I decided that because this story was set at the time of the witch trials, I decided to look at what we knew about him and his real life. And I discovered that there wasn't an awful lot about his early life. So I decided I would do something about that. That was interesting to me. The whole idea of nature and nurture is interesting in this book. And I also discovered that it was possible that they could have crossed paths. And so I wanted them to cross paths in such a way that when she first meets Matthew Hopkins, it's before he's the Witchfinder. He's just a young man who's travelling. And the encounter that they have, because of her anger, she behaves in a way that she realises later was very foolish. And what happens when they first meet changes both their lives. And he goes on to become the Witchfinder, and her life is changed by that encounter.
Well, we haven't really talked more about or much about this persecution of women and so forth, but not just women, because there are other people that are persecuted in the book, like the Irish and so forth, I think. Is it Gubbins? Or,
Yeah, Ned. And yes, that was the Gubbins were a real family.
Right.
They were an Irish family who lived in that area of the of the West Country, and I read a bit about the persecution of the Irish at the time. So he talks about that to her, about the abuse that he experiences. It was a real family who lived in caves in that area, and the word Gubbins was a sort of nickname that they were given. It was an abusive name, And it literally means the scrapings of when you're scaling fish, the slimy scrapings. So it was an abusive name. There are a number of elements like that. There's also the persecution. There's religious persecution, but there's also a kind of persecution of the Cornish people and their culture, and particularly their language, Kernuak. And that resonated for me because I'm aware because of the work that I've done on regional history here of the persecution of people. Obliterating a language is a very effective way to try and obliterate a people. So I was interested in that. But interestingly, in the last few months, the Cornish language, Kernuak, which has for years been considered a dead language, a language that is gone, has moved from being a dead language to becoming, it's taken a step up, it's now an endangered language. And it's just recently been given the same status as Gaelic and Welsh. So it will be taught in Cornish schools, and you can request to have to speak in Cornish in a court and have an interpreter. So yay for Kernuak.
I mean, that feels to me like a part of the just one more aspect of the project you're in, engaged in, which is that kind of almost like a preservation or a resurrection in many ways of the past and history. And it's, of course, very important to our collective memory. But I am wondering about what so fascinates you about the past. And you must see a clear connection between that and the present and present circumstances. It's almost like you're collapsing time. You spend so much of your time in the past and then so much of your time in the here and now with your own relationships and your own, you know, your own everyday business.
Are you sure you're not my therapist? Because we have covered this, me and my therapist. that's very interesting. I have been told by several people that I spend too much time in the past and I live in the past. But the honest truth is that for as long as I can remember, I've been weirdly obsessed with time, not in a scientific way, but how we experience time, memories. I love photographs and images of things in the past. I spend an unhealthy amount of time sitting thinking about what it means and, experiencing an hour that feels like 30 seconds. It's a facet. It's one of my life's main fascinations. I'm getting a bit weird now, but so you've really hit me to the core there, Will.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. That's okay. I'm finding it very helpful.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you're finding it helpful because I
may be confusing the audience, but I'm finding it really helpful.
I'm glad you're finding it helpful because I haven't finished yet. I'm just staying a lot on that sort of therapy line. I was just
going to talk about my mother, are we?
No. But we'll leave your mother out of this unless you want to talk about her, of course, because this is a safe space. You're welcome to talk about anything. You're amongst friends.
You weren't expecting this, were you?
I did want to ask, and I have asked this of other authors, so I'm not picking on you. To what extent does your creative work seep into your dreams, and to what extent do your dreams seep into your creative work? Because that is something that really fascinates me, the world of dreams.
Mm. Well, you mean literally the world of dreams?
Yeah, literally, as you sleep.
That's an invitation to a long answer. I do find that there's a lot that happens while I'm sleeping that I'm not aware of that is part of my dreams, and then I wake up and I very often have to then get up and go to my computer and act on whatever it is, because I didn't know that I knew that until I was asleep and I was dreaming it. So I think probably we're talking about the subconscious, and I think probably when the subconscious feels free and comfortable and safe and released, then a lot of the creative work comes from there, the ideas and the realizations. There are specific instances I can think of. Mike knows all of them because he's next to me when I wake up and say, I'm sorry, I've got to go and do whatever this is. And it's quite remarkable, really. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because the reason I ask this question is because you're talking about how important fact is to you and the whole idea of recording as accurately as possible what actually happened, and then where necessary, fictionalizing events. I mean, obviously, it has been necessary, particularly in the last two books. It also seems to me that the subconscious or the unconscious is where the best creative work and the creative ideas come from. So to me, you've got a kind of a, I don't know, it's almost like a dialectic, isn't it? You've got two things at loggerheads with each other, but you seem to be able to bring them together very well indeed in your fiction because it's so immersed in history.
It's a mysterious thing. It is mysterious. We were talking about it the other day and Mike said, well, maybe it is actually magic. Mm. And it's when I'm writing, when I'm really enjoying writing, when I'm completely immersed in it, it's almost as if I can't remember writing it when I'm finished. So I'll go into the other room and I'll read it to Mike. And he says, where did that come from? And I say, I don't know, because I don't. It's almost like it feels as if I'm inhabited by someone who can really write. And I say, okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm easy. Just take us time.
Well, it sounds like you're literally possessed, aren't you?
It happened again, sort of this morning. The audiobook has just been released, and the actor who's narrating it, Emma Powell. I hadn't heard it before. She's done the most incredible job. So I heard it I heard a bit of it for the first time this morning. And it was the strangest thing because she was reading a book to me and I don't remember being the person that wrote that book because I'm the reader, I'm the audience and someone's reading me a good book. it's like there are two people.
Yeah.
And if I can really get into the writing and relax myself, I'm on another plane. That's the only way I can describe it. And I think it probably is magic.
Yeah, absolutely. We keep coming back to that word, don't we, magic? And I can also see now why you have so much empathy with the main character here, who is also a shapeshifter, who also knows how to fly, which sounds exactly what you've described, actually, in psychological terms. Assume that's psychological. Mike, she doesn't actually fly. Ricky will change shape, no?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Not without an aircraft, anyway.
It's been very interesting that the things that readers have said to me about the flying. Mm. It's interesting to me the fact that the book is categorised as fantasy for libraries, which I think in some ways has directed it to some readers who it's not the right book for them. They're readers of fantasy, and I don't think of this as fantasy. I think it's the fact that the main character says, I can fly. That it's categorised as fantasy, maybe magic realism. But readers have said to me, well, you know, I have that experience. Or people have said, I dream that I can fly. It's very, very common. And when I was writing it, I had in mind a close friend of mine from many years ago. She was actually a mathematician and she was the most grounded, sensible educator that you could wish to meet. And she said to me one day, I have out-of-body experiences. When I was younger, I could willingly raise myself up out of my body and float. And then one day I found it difficult to get back into my body, so I didn't do it again. And I think the way that a reader interprets or understands the flying that she does in her youth is up to the reader to decide. Mm. You know, one lady said to me, I think it's a metaphor. And I know what I think, but that's, the book becomes a book when the reader takes it in their own way. It's their book. So, but I don't think of it as fantasy.
No, not at all. And I'm not sure how many people who've read the book here, but had the same experience. But I sort of kept flipping one to the other, depending on the circumstances. Whether, yes, it's obviously a metaphor. Yes, it's obviously a psychological condition. So, oh, she can actually fly. You know, like you said.
We better not talk about it because it would be a spoiler. But I'd be interested to know, perhaps on another occasion, what you thought about the very end, but we should probably
shouldn't
talk about
that. No, we shouldn't talk about that. You've had a quite a long and varied career, actually. This is feels like only a small fraction of what you've done throughout your life, so it's been incredible. But I'm wondering to what extent studying modern languages has really catapulted you into this sort of area where you language is so important to you as a vehicle for portraying history in this way, this sort of, and your extraordinary command of language. You know, it's much closer to poetry than it is to straight biography, for example, in your previous books, and obviously not in this case because this is fiction. But I'm just wondering about how your formative years and your education, how much of that has gone into making you the writer you are today.
I think there's a huge amount. You know, when I think back to the things I studied as a as an undergraduate student, particularly, not so much when I was studying education. My master's was in education, so that was quite a different thing. That was more to do with understanding people and how people learn. But I think that the things that I loved, in high school and as an undergraduate, it was languages, it was literature, the way that words in different languages mean slightly different things. And, you know, studying Spanish, there would sometimes be something that you'd want to say and only the Spanish word would do. So my friends and I would just use the Spanish word. There's a Spanish word, maja, and it kind of means funky or beautiful, but there isn't really an English word. You know, that a woman is muy maja. I don't think there's a word in English that you would use. But I don't think it was so much the education. I think it was, those were the things I loved as a child. So that's why I chose to study English literature and languages. And it's also why after my first degree, I decided to do a teaching certificate. But instead of doing the expected thing of going to high school and teaching English or teaching modern languages, I did a primary teaching course because I wanted to teach across the curriculum. I wanted to teach everything. I didn't really want to teach PE, maths and science, but pretty much everything else. So I was able to carry on with all those things that interested me. And I was, my first love as a reader was poetry. When I was a small child, I'd read all the poetry in the children's library. So I had a special concession ticket to read poetry from the adult library. So I think it was sort of inevitable. It wasn't so much what I studied. It was the route that I chose. Yes. I've been very lucky. I've always been able to study and work in areas that that I feel very passionate about. I've been very fortunate.
To what extent have activities, let's say, in the real world affected your writing? I'm thinking about gardening and more manual activities, because it strikes me sometimes that a lot of writers' knowledge of the senses is theoretical more than practical. They're not the kinds of people you'd find out in the garden with a spade, or they're not the kinds of people that you'd find even, I don't know, swimming, for example. They're less physical. Whereas it's the way you write, it seems to me like all the senses are engaged, and that can only really come from someone who lives in the world.
Yeah, I think, if you're a writer, you do spend a lot of time sitting, and you spend, a lot of people write outside in the garden. But you spend a lot of time being quite sedentary. But I think if the kind of literature that I enjoyed reading and the kind of thing that I enjoy writing is very much in the real world, in the natural world. I'm not so sure I enjoy it. There are descriptions of the city in London, in Sarah Evans, the city in 1790 and 1800, and I did enjoy that, but I enjoy most of all describing settings which are gardens, particularly the places I love. It's about a place. Beaches, the granite moorlands in Cornwall. So I enjoy gardening because I enjoy being in that setting, not because I enjoy the gardening. Yes. I just like being out there. You know, I don't like laying in the sun, but I do like pottering around and listening. And, when the wattle comes into flower and you get that amazing kind of coconut smell wafting. You suddenly you smell it, and then you look, and then you see the first yellow flowers. It's maybe just a visual thing. I think my writing is always cinematic. I know that when I'm writing a scene, when I'm introducing a scene, I don't write it. The first thing I have to do is see it. So I see it almost like watching it on a screen. And then when I've seen it, I find the words to describe what I was looking at. So that's the way that I do it. Mm. So, and I love paintings, and I'm a visual person. Mm. When I was studying, if I needed to remember something, I would draw something. I would have a page with words and pictures and boxes, and that's how I would remember it. Which is probably why I'm not very good at maths. Can't remember my phone number.
You could be good at geometry, though.
I was good at geometry. You are my therapist. I was really good at geometry because it was pictures.
Visual.
Yeah.
you must feel blessed then, you guys living where you do in the world. It's a beautiful part of the world, and it has everything you described. So, I mean, other writers maybe sitting in some sort of tiny box somewhere in the suburbs and not get that chance to engage with the world, as you say.
Yeah, I think how lucky I am, probably more than once a day. Mm. You know, Mike always says it took us 60 years to get this, or 50 years to get that lucky. It wasn't always like that. I've lived in some pretty awful little boxes with sharing the place with mice, and so I've done my share of that, but it is permanently I'm in a writing retreat. I don't need to go away and have a retreat. For me, the retreat is coming to the city, and I can actually go in a shop and buy the thing that I want. So it's a rural retreat, and it's a constant source of not just inspiration but sort of comfort and solace. And if things are difficult, the easiest thing for me to do is to just get in the car and drive for 2 minutes to the beach. And that's why it says in the biography, as I spend as much time as I can at the edge of the land. Mm. I lived for about 20, 25 years because life took me in that direction in the English Midlands. So I was living in Northampton, which, if you imagine the shape of England, Northampton is as far from any coast as you can physically get in England. So I had geographical claustrophobia for 20 years, 25 years. I used to long to just be at the edge of the land and see the ocean. And in fact, that's when I wrote the prologue for this book 35 years ago. I was sitting in Northampton and I was aching, literally, physically aching for Cornwall to just breathe the sea air and be something about being on the edge of the land. And that's certainly why I ended up south of Margaret River, because after moving from there, I came here on a holiday, as so many people do, and I arrived in Margaret River and I felt as if I'd come home. Mm.
Beautiful.
I just felt as if I'd come home, and I was welcomed by the people and the place and the wildlife. And it's not my second home, it's my other home.
Yeah. So maybe the last question before we take questions from the audience. I'm aware I haven't asked you too much about your influence, but influences.
I'm wondering what this is.
However, I was just curious because I was thinking about a novelist like Daphne du Maurier, who's also from Cornwall, and Rebecca, based on Jane Eyre. So there's a little bit of connection going on there. Mm. But anyways, that aside, I'm just really curious about whether your reading necessarily gravitates towards other historical novelists or whether you read much more broadly than that.
I gravitate obsessively towards other historical novelists. I do sometimes read other things, but that's because I belong to a book club. And very occasionally we read other things that I think, oh, that's absolutely great. But if I'm in a bookshop and I'm skimming the shelves, it's and when I say historical, I'm not terribly, it sounds awful, but I'm not terribly interested in anything prior to about 1850. I don't know why. I don't know why. Lynn smiled, perhaps you're the same. I don't know why. It's not to do with the clothes or I don't know. If I think of history, I suppose it's further away. There's that sort of distance in time that makes it more interesting to me. I remember once we went to visit a museum when we went to the UK on a trip, the Black Country Museum, I think it was. Wonderful old place. And they had a sort of village set up and there was a pharmacy, a chemist's shop. And we went in there and on the shelf was a perfume bottle that I once had. And I realised that my life was in a museum and I was getting that old. And I think, you know, people say now, oh, it's historical. And I look at this book and it's the 1970s. So for me, for it to be interesting historically, it has to be kind of before my parents were born. That not having a connection, I think.
That being said, though, are you talking about historical novelists or contemporary novelists like yourself writing about that past that you're interested in?
Or both.
Both.
Both. Yes. It started when I was a child and it's just still the same. The Lorna Doone book I won as the prize when I was 10, and I won the class prize 3 years running. So when I was 8, the first book, you were allowed to choose your prize, and I chose Jane Eyre. Mm. So I read Jane Eyre when I was 8. The following year, I chose Wuthering Heights. So I read Wuthering Heights when I was 9. And then when I was 10, I read Lorna Doone. So I think it was kind of inevitable that I would tend towards the dark side. Women's stories. And, you know, I think the Gothic has never left me, really. I don't know whether it was inevitable or whether it was nurture and it was the school I went to. I don't know. I'm just quite glad that's the direction I went in.
Okay. Well, I'm also glad we're at the end, because if we go down that Gothic rabbit hole, we're probably going to end up talking a lot of dark matter. Look, I think we might leave it there, because we want to allow people enough time to mill around, ask key questions, have a chat, and buy some books, of course. So I'd like to thank the City of Perth Library and Pigface Books tonight, and the wonderful team led by Lena over there.
Can we thank Will as well?
If you like. Okay, and thank you to Bernice, of course.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.